the issue is people keep thinking that there is a finish line, and the reality is that AI is a marathon. It's a long race. I mean, even a marathon has a finish line, but we are in the beginning of this race, and there's no clear winner.
Hello, welcome to the Big Bang Tech Report. Medvi, Matthew Gallagher, and a story that just hit the New York Times. Medvi shows how AI can turn a one-man company into a business with massive scale. So the big question is, are we looking at a wild exception, or is that the future of new business? My guest is Alvin Graylan. Alvin, great to have you here.
Hey, Hank, good to see you again. It's been a couple of weeks. A lot of things are happening in this space.
Like always. Let's start with the big one. Is this a crazy exception or the start of a new business area? Are very small AI-powered companies the future?
So we've actually talked about this maybe a month or 2 months ago, where we said, hey, will these new AI tools enable companies that are very small to become very effective? And clearly, I think Matthew Gallagher, his example is a good example of a single person. Later, he hired his brother, so it became a two person company. But to be able to do what used to take dozens or hundreds of people, and I actually don't think this is an exception. But I think what might be an exception is the scale of what he created. I think in the first year, he had over $400 million in revenue. That's quite impressive for a single person company. But, if you look back at his background, he actually has a type of skills that we had talked about before, that, he was both an entrepreneur and he was a coder, a technologist, right? And so we said that was the kind of skill set you would need kind of both to be able to do this type of a company. And he also found a segment of the business that was relatively kind of low development work. He was essentially selling, right? So he created the website and the marketplace to sell GLP-1 drugs, which was very popular at the time. Now, so then you're essentially just a channel for distribution and for ordering, which if you have the right tools, you can make a website and make a commerce site very quickly. So I think he was fortunate to find the right niche at the right time, and he definitely leveraged all the tools out there to make that happen. And I think
so. That's not a role model for a lot of thousands of people who will leave the university right now and start an entrepreneur career.
I think it's it could be a role model for you to start a business, but I don't think most people should have the expectation you're going to create a $1 billion company, right? I think that's the difference. I actually agree with what you said earlier, that longer term, more and more people will move from big corporations to being in kind of self-employed type of a situation, which I may not be a bad thing because it creates a lot more autonomy. But when everybody does that, the type of opportunities become saturated or the arbitrage opportunities go away very quickly, right? So,
but that's something like the startup culture, that three or four roommates come together, have an idea, share the idea, build up a company, and then they are looking for employees. But this is very different from that, right?
I mean, I actually came from the startup world. I am actually in Silicon Valley right now, where kind of that's the center. And in traditional startup, what happens is you have an idea, you get a few teammates, you go and you get VC money, you build an idea that solves a problem that was not solved well before. And you do it, 5x, 10x better than anybody else, right? That's kind of the general formula. And then, at some point you keep raising more money and then you go public, right? Matthew Gallagher is what his example shows is that, if there are opportunities to maybe actually disrupt some of the existing businesses that are relatively simple businesses that are just not necessarily developing, but distributing or selling or marketing, things that does not require new innovation. It's maybe an innovation in terms of efficiency, but not necessarily innovation in terms of a brand new product. Because to build and design, let's say you want to build a new silicon chip, or you want to design a new drug, it's going to take a team of people, right? Whereas if you're just selling something, that's something that can be automated and done fairly well with today's tools. So there's definitely opportunity. I'm just saying that people need to temper what they believe the upside, the top side of where this potential can go. So
this is fantastic because it's a real productivity story, and I think AI is mostly a productivity story, but this is one very exceptional.
I think AI is a productivity story today, but at some point in the near future, AI actually becomes an innovation story as well. Because we will find that the AI tools will get good enough to be able to create new molecules, new drugs, new solutions. But you know, those are going to be kind of the biggest models, or maybe some more very specialized models, right? You look at something like AlphaFold. Everybody thinks, oh, AlphaFold is creating new protein folding, must be a giant model. It's only 93 million parameters. It's actually a very tiny model that can run on my laptop. Right. So if you have specialized data and you have specialized people that know how to train it, you can create unique capabilities. It could be both, right? It could be about efficiency and productivity. It could be also about innovation when the right people with the right background are leveraging it.
Evan, you are not just watching the trends, this trend. You are also a co-author of the Stanford paper on enterprise AI. So let me ask you this. What is the real message of this report, of that report?
So the enterprise AI playbook just came out last week, and it was co-authored by Elisa Pereira and Eric Reynolds and I. And so it's out of the Stanford Digital Economy Lab, right? We've been working on it for about 6 months. And what it really shows is that the majority of the problems that are keeping people from successfully deploying AI is not the technology, it's not the model. You know, it's all, well, not all, but 70, 80% of it is organization, is people, is incentive systems, it's fear, it's organizational, right? And the good news about that is if it's organizational, it's something that any company can fix. Anybody with a good leader who sets the right objectives, who gets involved, who encourages and measures properly, and gets the team to work together, they can be successful implementing, right? What you saw last year, there was a paper that came out of MIT that said, 95% of AI systems fail or deployments fail, so this stuff doesn't work. And we actually found the opposite. It's not that it doesn't work. Actually, it works very well, right? In fact, even companies that had very ill-managed data, that it's not well-sorted, not labeled, they still got high productivity gains, right? It's really about making sure that your workflow integrates with the AI versus just inserting AI into existing workflow. Right. You look at like the example we just talked about with Matthew, where he essentially just figured, okay, what can I do to do this? I can use AI to do the marketing. I can AI to do the customer service. I can do AI to manage my inventory, etc. Right. And when you do that, it's different than somebody saying, okay, well, I have a sales company. How can I just replace one piece of it? If you replace one piece or one function, then everybody else is the same. You're not going to get any productivity gains because that one thing might be 10 times faster, but it'll be waiting for all the other things before and after it, so you don't see any real benefit, right? And I think this, So I think this is actually the key is if you're going to do AI, don't do it just for a single function. Relook at the entire flow of your service or product, of your internal operations, and find out where are all the places that it could benefit. And then when you streamline that process, you'll automatically get a lot of these benefits.
But to understand this, to understand AI as a CEO, you must have the mindset of a student. You have the mindset of somebody who wants to learn, who wants to understand what's going on in the future. Do you see that in the US, that people, that they go back in their mindset to the university?
Actually, here's the funny thing is it's Stanford actually has an executive program, and they have these sometimes 1 or 2 week programs where they'll bring in very senior executives, sometimes CEOs and CXOs, to come in and understand what's happening with technology. And when they go back, then they have the right mindset that you're talking about in terms of understanding that, okay, it can do these things and not be the resistance, right? The thing that also was interesting from the study was that essentially, in about half of the cases, the models were complete commodity. It didn't matter which model they picked. They thought they were all the same. It's really about the scaffolding of how you put it together, and the workflow. Once you've done that right, then most of the job is done. There are certain cases, let's say if you're doing coding, people do prefer certain models like Claude is very good at coding. But for a lot of things, let's say you're looking at, let's say, invoicing, or you're looking at, monitoring cameras, there's a lot of models that could do these type of things and do it well. And in fact, what we also found was that as agents came in, companies who are implementing agentic technologies were getting an average something like 70% increase in productivity. Companies that were doing on high autonomy, essentially saying, have human in loop, but only when something breaks, then talk to the human, you're getting maybe 40 to 50% improvement in productivity. And when there's a lot of human, everything has to be checked and approved by the human, you're getting maybe 20% improvement in productivity. So the more you offload, the more you delegate to the AI, the higher the productivity, right? Now, the lesson there is not saying, hey, offload everything. The lesson there is understand which task that when it fails, that is reversible. And which things are repeated activities. So if you know that something repeats and it's being done every day or every hour, then automate that, right? And let AI make those decisions. But if it's a decision that, once you make it, you can't change it, then having humans in the loop makes a lot of sense. So really being able to differentiate.
But if productivity goes up very fast, what happens to the people? What happens to the office jobs, for example? We have already discussed it, but what is your advice to people who feel that their job could be automated?
This is actually one of the findings that I find a little disturbing in the sense of the technology that of the companies that we had talked to, essentially were things that are probably from a year to some of them maybe from 2 years ago, because it takes such a long time to go through large companies of deploying these technologies. And all of them had to have at least 3 months of value before we even considered them to be a successful case to be put into interview. Even in that case, 45% of the leaders of these companies said, we will, when we see this productivity, we will replace the humans with the productivity gains, which means that's almost half of the people, half of the companies would choose in replacement. And then another 19% of them said, well, we won't replace people because that's not nice, but what we will do is stop hiring. Right. And if you put that together, that's about 65% of the total, the total hiring, which means essentially two thirds of the case, either you're not hiring or you're not, or you're displacing existing workers, which has the same impact on the labor force, right? And that's with old technology of a year or 2 years ago. Just imagine what's happening today. And you know how much AI capabilities have improved over the last 3 months, right? That I would expect these numbers to go up even higher over time. And I think that this is where the fear comes from, and it's warranted. And this is also why, as we talked about earlier, the governments need to start thinking about how do we put in programs to either slow down or create more incentives for employers to keep hiring or to maintain their workforce, or at least provide enough benefits that there's a soft landing, right?
So let's make it a little bit more practical, because this change will first hit the normal office day. We have right now, we have meetings, emails, slides, reports, follow-ups. What changes first?
I think it's actually going to change the anybody that is in front of a computer. If you're doing repetitive work, there's high exposure to automation. right? And it changes the middle layer of management actually a lot that I think people don't talk about, because we keep talking about junior workers. I think, yes, the junior workers, there'll be a lot less hiring of those. Unless you're really skilled at AI, maybe then you can say, hey, I can take over five of your prior guys and I'm a new person. But but the middle layer used to be, their job was to pass information from the lower layers to the higher layers. And what's happening right now, if you put in the right framework for information transfer with these AI agents, and you put in, you know, automatic monitoring systems, some of the things that we talked about in our last episode, that the CEO is no longer the last to know. The CEO is no longer, or, you know, maybe your senior manager, maybe not necessarily CEO, but the senior manager is no longer the people who know the least about the organization, because they could potentially have a direct line into operational data, right? And not need somebody to pass again and again. And every filter, you lose information. Every filter, somebody's hiding something that might benefit them, right? So I think the need for middle management actually becomes a real question, and there's a lot of people in that segment of the job market.
Yeah, so we see less admin, more judgment, less execution, more responsibility.
And that, in some ways, I think will make not just companies more efficient, but make the society more efficient. But you know, when you're more efficient, that the reality is that there will be people who won't be able to find a place to go, right? So what happens to them? So this is the government issue that needs to get addressed.
Yeah, but do you think that we will see what we have had in Germany in the 80s, 4 days or 35 hours weeks, and we will see a 30 hours week, a 25 hours week? Is that something what you see in the future, that we work only 1 day a week or 2 days a week?
I think that would be the optimal situation, that more companies would say, rather than firing 21% of my staff, I'll move to a 4 day work week. Rather than firing 40% of staff, I would move to a 3 day work week. Now, the question is, do you maintain the same pay? If you do, then the shareholders are going to say, well, you just got all this productivity gains. Why are you giving your people more time off? There will be certain more ethical, more moral leaders that would make that choice and say, I'll give my people more free time. I don't know how many people will do that, particularly in capitalistic markets. So I think if the government says, you know, that the government wants everybody to move to a 4 day work week, maybe then it essentially regulates and enforces that type of a working model, then that might actually make more sense. If you allow companies to work on their own, I think it will be a minority of companies that would make that choice.
Yeah. Let's switch to our question we have nearly in every episode. Every day people ask me, who is building the best machine? Everybody asks the same question, who is ahead? How do you see Claude, Qwen, OpenAI? Where are we right now?
I think, you know, the issue is people keep thinking that there is a finish line, and the reality is that AI is a marathon. It's a long race. I mean, even a marathon has a finish line, but we are in the beginning of this race, and there's no clear winner, right? In the sense of there is maybe a leader for the week or leader for the day, and maybe a leader in a certain segment, but not in other segments. The reality is that all of these labs are doing very similar things. And I think it really doesn't matter in the sense of more than a week or a month, who is the leader, because I feel like right now we're actually taking the wrong approach from the entire industry perspective. This focus on being ahead is very energy intensive, compute intensive, you know, human effort intensive, but it's not necessarily generating value, right? You look at what happened last week with the Claude code source leak, right? Their source code leaked, and you know what took probably, you know, $1 billion of development is now open source to everyone. And I would expect that over the next 1 to 1 month, probably, Every company will look at this code and say, what are the things I can learn from it and how I can use that to make my AI and my scaffolding as strong as Claude Code was. And Claude Code was actually probably more important than Claude Opus or Claude Sonnet, the model, in terms of what brought value, right? And this is also what the research that I was talking about showed, is that how you use the AI is more important than which AI you choose. And the framework will allow that to be now the best possible, at least the best available framework will now be available to every model maker.
Okay. But which world model do you use? And
so I use a combination of them, but for coding tasks, I still use Claude and Claude Code, Claude Cowork. I think they're very, very functional for graphics. I use Gemini Nano Banana, and for some writing, I still actually go back to ChatGPT, and if I'm looking at news and tweets, I go to Grok, or to Perplexity. So different models provide different value, right? So I don't think I don't know of anybody who is serious who uses only one model for everything.
Okay, so what is the biggest AI mistake leaders make right now?
What's the biggest mistake, you said?
Yeah, is there a mistake? Do you see something right now? You're in San Francisco right now, right? Yeah, and you're in the middle of everything. And do you see that something is going wrong?
I mean, from a company implementation perspective or from a industry perspective and lab perspective?
From the company that the companies are not adapting it fast enough. And what do you see there?
The key is really a willingness to fail from the leader, right? So if you're a company leader, don't expect that you use AI, it's going to be perfect, and everybody's going to have a 2x improvement in productivity, and there'll be no snacks. The reality is that this is a new technology. There's a lot of resistance in organizations because of the fear that we talked about, and things will fail for multiple types of reasons. And the one actually interesting finding that we had from from the paper was about 65% of the companies that were successful also failed first. So they failed first, and then they kept going. And 100% of the people that were successful after failure were the same leaders who took on the projects, who drove the projects during the failed projects. So don't punish people when they fail, right? Because if you do, then the other person will make the same mistakes, but relearn this lesson again and again. You need to let people have the permission to fail, and you need to encourage them. And the CEOs have to be in the meetings. They have to come, they have to show they care, and they have to show that this is not a pilot project that is just to test. They have to show that this is a mandate for change. And when you do that, good things happen. In fact, yesterday I was in a call with the staff of the Stanford Digital Economy Lab, and they had an example of a company that all the CEO did was he said, in the next year, I want everybody to double your productivity. Right? I mean, it sounds like a very crazy, crazy mandate. But the fact that they did that, they went and then they showed a chart when they announced this mandate to the next year, over 3 months, they essentially productivity per person doubled, right? Because he kept every meeting, he's like, how are you using AI? What are you using to help make yourself better? And completely pushing that. And if you use this technology properly, it will absolutely bring benefit.
Yeah. So AI is not just a changing tool. It is changing the company itself. It is changing productivity. It is changing office work, and it is changing what leaders must do next. The question is no longer, will this happen? And the real question is that who moves first? And that's in every industry or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think moving first matters, and it will give you an advantage, but it's not a sustainable advantage, right? Because these technologies are changing so quickly that even if you deployed right now with a model and you didn't change with it, you didn't update it, then whoever the new person comes in with another person in the industry, they may actually have the new version and be able to leapfrog you, right? So it's not just doing it first. It's really maintaining a culture of innovation, maintaining a culture of learning, like what you just said, to be able to say, whoever's doing this, you need to keep up to date every day. And because this industry is changing on a daily basis, sometimes on an hourly basis. And if you're behind, then you will lose. But that what that also does is it really makes the pace of competition much higher. And you're running on this treadmill where you don't necessarily get ahead because everybody's now getting.
Yeah, today I talked to an entrepreneur and he said, okay, in the beginning I was against AI. And I said, okay, what's that? And they said, okay. And then I learned a little bit and then I saw that my productivity went up. And so what I have charged until now for 4 hours, I can do it in 1 hour. And he will charge it for 3 or 2 hours, and then he has a lot of much more benefits. And so I think that's a story we see right now in Germany, more and more as a small Mittelstand, SME, that people realize that it is no question being against it. It is a question learning and having much more profit.
Although I also think that that's a temporary... That's a temporary arbitrage opportunity of the benefits because as more and more people know this, they will be able to say, hey, I think you use AI to help you. I think it only took you an hour, you know, and then so you may not be able to charge 3 hours, or they'll find another person who will charge maybe an hour and a half. And so in the short term, yes, there will be advantages for people who use it. But I think over time, pretty much everybody will start to integrate this into their workflow.
We will see. Alvin, thank you very much. This was a Big Bang Tech Report, and see you next time. And I think we have a lot of stories to tell, right?
The world is changing. Welcome. And make sure you subscribe and like this podcast. Thanks.
Yeah, okay. See you soon. Bye.